from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dave Boyle's new film has been described as neo-noir. It's a mystery, a detective story, a thriller. And if you know Boyle's own backstory, it's a pretty good fit. For a very brief time, he had a detective agency in his boyhood neighborhood of Tucson. I don't think he solved any crimes, and this phase didn't last very long, but it was the kind of stuff he loved, suspense and clues and complicated characters taking story strands and trying to make them make sense. Oh, there's another thing about Boyle's film. It's mostly in Japanese, which is another part of his backstory we'll explore today as we continue our series on documentary film, though this is not a documentary. We're mixing it up this month. Tonight, we're screening Man from Reno at the Rose Wagner Theater. We hope you'll join us then and right after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary film, our partnership with the Utah Film Center, though this time we've put a twist in the series. This month's film is actually not a documentary. It's a feature film, and even that has a twist. It's a film that is, I guess you could call it, bilingual. Most of the main characters are Japanese. They speak in Japanese, so it has the feel of a foreign film, but it's set in San Francisco. And then there's one strand that plays out in a small American town with a sheriff tracking down a mysterious figure. This is the kind of place Dave Boyle has carved out for himself in independent film, weaving American and Japanese characters and stories together. We decided to profile Boyle's film because of his connection to Utah. He lived here for a time, and he set some of his films here, too. There's actually not a lot we can say about the film we're profiling. It's called Man from Reno, and we'll get to a basic plot here in a moment, but it's a thriller, so we don't want to give anything away. Dave Boyle joined us in studio yesterday, and we began with a conversation about his home in Tucson, Arizona, and the films he really liked when he was growing up.
I watched a lot of what probably everybody else in my generation watched. I remember when I was 7 going to see Batman in the theaters and seeing, you know, the Disney animated movies that came around at that time, like The Little Mermaid and everything. I slowly got more and more adventurous as I got older. Both my dad and his dad, my grandpa, who actually lives here in Salt Lake, were huge movie buffs. And so I'd hear about all these movies that, you know, I probably wasn't old enough to see. And then when I got old enough, you know, when we were at Blockbuster, I would be asking my dad if I could rent, you know, like a Woody Allen movie or something. And he was kind of like, well, I don't know. So it kind of slowly but surely led me into seeing stuff that was more interesting, more sophisticated, more international movies. You know, seeing when I was a teenager, seeing like Kurosawa's movies was had a huge impact on me.
Really?
Yeah.
And this was way before you learned Japanese or took a really deep interest in Japanese culture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, way before that. I mean, I think just in general, for whatever reason, when I started seeing international movies, subtitled movies, those felt more like movies to me in a way.
Wow.
because it really was, you know, a window into something that was unfamiliar to me. And there was just something about it that was interesting. And I think that early on I kind of had this idea that, you know, the real movies are movies that come from other places and not from here.
Yeah. Did that have anything to do with, you think, the fact that you were I don't know what the environment was like for you. I imagine you grew up Mormon in Tucson, and like a lot of sort of Mormon kids, sheltered environments, looking at the world outside is kind of exotic and exciting. Was that part of it at all?
Actually, I kind of had a little bit of the opposite experience. Huh. My parents, you know, moved to Tucson because they didn't want me to grow up, you know, surrounded by other Mormons. And I mean, of course, there are lots of Mormons in Tucson, but I was the only, my sister and I were the only Mormons in our middle school and high school. Wow. And then so it was quite the opposite. Coming to Utah was
exotic.
Like this huge culture shock. Every summer I used to go when I was in junior high and high school, I'd go to BYU's theater and film camp. And that was just like, you know, that was through the looking glass for me. I mean, it was really interesting.
Yeah.
But I sort of got the sense from talking to other LDS kids who are from Utah that they were having a very, very different experience than I was.
So the Kurosawa that you saw when you were a kid, and you later came back to getting this interest, which we'll get into a little bit later, you know, in Japanese culture. What do you think it was about Kurosawa? And I'm wondering, were you also interested in like Japanese animation films too in those days?
I wasn't very interested in Japanese animation at the time. And in fact, my interest in animation was a little bit of a fleeting thing, because I always knew that whatever it was I was going to do, it was going to be about storytelling. So the first thing that I told my parents, you know, when I grow up, I want to be this, was that I told them I wanted to be an author illustrator. I wanted to make books like, you know, I don't know, like Corduroy or things like that.
Yeah.
And then that turned to animation. And then somewhere along the line, I realized how painstaking and time-consuming animation is, and it kind of transferred into a more of an interest in live-action stuff. But I think that my older sister had a school assignment about Shakespeare where she had to watch Kurosawa's I'm trying to remember the English title, Throne of Blood, which is an adaptation of Macbeth. And I just kind of sat in and watched it with her, and it had this really kind of primal, stark, you know, graphic quality about it that that was, you know, it was energizing. Yeah. It was really, you know, everything about it, from the acting style to the direction, the way it comes together, the kind of images that he chose to tell his story, just seemed just alive to me. And you know, that movie ends with Toshiro Mifune getting shot by like 300 arrows, and it's all in one take, and you know, and they actually really did it. You know, they really shot him with all those arrows. And so, as a 12, 13 year old, however old I was, I mean, that was like I'd never seen anything like it, and I wanted more.
Yeah. So when you came back to doing films that had Japanese characters and Japanese situations, was that a reference point for you in some way at all?
Probably not consciously,
yeah.
Because especially when I first started out, I was doing stuff that was very, very different from the kind of thing. I mean,
right,
yeah,
funny and
light, and so it was actually. It's funny, one of the reasons I changed direction is because a couple years ago somebody asked me to make a list of my favorite movies. I think it was my favorites of the decade or something.
Yeah.
And I noticed that every single thing that I put on my list was all like a film noir, a mystery, or a thriller. And it just kind of, I don't know why I started down the light comedy thing, but I, you know, I'm not really a very funny person. So it kind of clicked. I was like, maybe I need to kind of change direction and do something that I would really, really love to see, you know, as a viewer. And that's what led to Man from Reno.
I know you've talked about Crimes and Misdemeanors. Was that on the list?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think it's a great film. There's a...
talking noir, right? I mean, this
noir.
Is the... And something dark.
I think, like, the Maltese Falcon was always... I remember... When I saw that when I was 10 years old, everything was going way over my head, but yeah. I still really loved everything about it, the intensity of it. And I really love complicated stories that, you know, you can't necessarily pass a test on everything that happened after it's over,
right.
That kind of demand reviewing. And like Chinatown is, I think, is a wonderful movie, and Rosemary's Baby.
Talk about a complicated story. Wow.
Yeah. And then in more recent years, The Ghost Rider, the Polanski film, not the Nicolas Cage motorcycle movie.
Right. But, yeah.
So, I don't know. I think that there was definitely something early on where I was attracted to stuff that was a little bit on the darker side. But then when I started making movies, it was like these, you know, creme brulee type movies. And, I don't know.
But I think a lot of people do that, though, don't you think? I mean, they go for the kind of easier thing, or at least the image that.
Well, that's, I think that's why I did it, but what I learned was that it's actually harder, especially if you're not naturally attuned to that.
Yeah, because you don't feel it.
Yeah, I mean, on a Friday night, my idea of fun is not to sit down and watch something super light and funny. I want to watch something that is gonna, you know, that's gonna twist my brain into pretzels and, you know, be a real puzzle that I can think about for days afterward. And that's not to say that, you know, I like a variety of things, but when it comes right down to what I truly love, then, you know, the kind of puzzle movies are the things that I gravitate toward.
You mentioned storytelling. That was the one thing that you knew you wanted to do in some way, was tell a story when you were a kid. Tell stories. So I read this thing that said you had, like, your own library?
Oh, yeah.
Is there anything to that? Because I know you said you wanted to write books. So did you, is that true? Did you, or is that just a kind of a silly kid thing that, I mean, I think it was interesting.
It was pretty silly. I mean, when I was a kid, I started a variety of little ventures. I started a detective agency where I'd charge 25 cents to solve a case, and that didn't really go anywhere. And yeah, I did I did make a whole library full of my own homemade books that I would check out to my sisters. And, you know, I think that probably lasted for all of a day and a half.
Yeah.
It was this, you know, at the time, it consumed everything. I was like, I'm doing this, but... I don't know. It seems like I was always jumping in one step too far. Like you don't make a library. You got to write a book. You know. It's not, so that's a tendency that continues with me to this day, I think.
When did you first become? I mean, beyond the Kurosawa stuff, I guess you became interested in Japanese culture at first because you went to Australia and you were a Mormon missionary and you taught Japanese people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the way in?
Yeah, that was pretty much that was how it happened. It was pretty much serendipitous, and I think, you know, I mean, it was a fascinating experience on a lot of levels, and I felt like for the first time I kind of had a little bit of a at least somewhat easy familiarity with a culture or a language other than my own, and.
Right.
And I also felt like seeing the experiences that the Japanese folks that I knew in Australia went through and kind of navigating their way through a foreign country were also really interesting. We spent a lot of a significant amount of time, you know, helping people out of jams, whether it was translating for them with the police or with their landlords or with that kind of thing. And, you know, it was from a storyteller's perspective, it was a really fascinating experience. So I soaked up a lot of stuff like a sponge.
I read an interview where you said, though, that if you had been sent to Mexico for a missionary work, that you might have ended up making Spanish language films. Is that true?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And I still would like to. There are a couple of Spanish language projects I'd really love to do. Of course, it just kind of helps to have. When you're judging performance and everything, I mean, even though I do speak Japanese, I'm not 100%. So sometimes I do have to rely on the actors to kind of say, you know, I don't know if we would do it this way and that kind of thing. So, I do think that mission experience was huge in terms of determining what my first movie was going to be about. And then it kind of snowballed from there, from one project to the next.
But what was it about the culture, if you can identify this? I mean, aside from the fact that it was different and you related to it in some way where you were, was there anything about Japanese culture in particular that you really found intriguing or interesting that you wanted to maybe do something with, even if you didn't think about it in those terms, at least in those days? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's sort of a je ne sais quoi thing about Japanese culture that is, you know, I guess I just, I feel reasonably comfortable in Japan or, you know, in Japanese business situations or things like that. Sometimes more comfortable than I would in the American counterpart to the same situation. And, there's, you know, I definitely have a deep affection for the culture and, fascination with the language, for sure.
I mean, it seems pretty brave, to be honest with you, that a white guy really approaches films from such a Japanese perspective. And not only that, but in some cases, to the point where they're bilingual films. I mean, they're and I would say, you know, Man from Reno is, what, two-thirds in Japanese, maybe?
Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's gutsy as a filmmaker also, just in terms of, and I'm sure you think about this kind of thing, and we'll get back to it a little bit later, but just sort of it's a commercial appeal and all of that kind of things. But I mean, the fact that you've committed to it to that degree seems kind of gutsy.
Gutsy or stupid, depending on who you ask. But I mean, with Man from Reno, it was a little different because that was a co-production with a Japanese company. And so it you know, it was kind of, for all intents and purposes, it is a Japanese movie.
Yeah.
It just happens to have an American director and a lot of Americans in the cast. For my other films, it kind of, while my first film was super small and something that I just made with my friends, it kind of opened my eyes to how many talented Asian American as well as Japanese actors there are in LA who, you know, have spent years honing their craft and getting whatever roles that they can. And yet there isn't like a market necessarily for, I think it's starting to change, but there aren't people beating down their doors with opportunities to star in to play really significant roles in movies. And I really fell in love with this actor I met on my first film named Hiroshi Watanabe, and I actually wrote my next film, White on Rice, with him in mind.
Yeah.
And then I cast everybody else that I had met kind of through the process of making that first film, just because I was, you know,
I think that's interesting because Watanabe is so he's not highly charismatic. He's not, I mean, he's such a kind of an unassuming character.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I find that interesting that you would say, this guy's fascinating. I want to build a whole movie around him.
Yeah, I felt like, first of all, that he was, you know, he's a little bit of a character. He's a little bit of a chameleon. And he's also kind of the last person that you'd expect to have the movie centered around. You'd expect him to be.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I guess I'm fascinated by character actors. And, you know, Pepe Serna who I've worked with many times, is sort of the classic case of that. But the guys who you see pop up all the time, and they're great actors, but they're always just in one scene. Or
they're the sidekick or whatever.
Exactly. And for me, it's I don't know, something about that, it's interesting for me to kind of turn the camera on them and let them carry the movie and see where that takes us. I mean, it results in a very different kind of movie. But for whatever reason, that's always fascinated me.
Dave Boyle, he directed the indie film Man from Reno. We're screening it tonight at 7 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Dave Boyle will be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on documentary film, though this month we're trying something different. The film we're talking about today and screening tonight is not a documentary. It's a feature, a thriller, made by filmmaker Dave Boyle. It's about a Japanese mystery writer who falls into a mystery of her own. That strand collides with another missing person case in a small town, and that's pretty much all we can say about it for now. Dave Boyle joined us to talk about his film yesterday and his fascination with Japanese culture.
So I know you didn't go to film school. In fact, it's funny because I wanted to actually talk to you about this. I can't tell if you don't like the idea of film school, or if you just think that I want to look at this quote you said. You said sometimes film school puts people in a trap of making movies that are pastiches of things they've already seen. What I guess I want to ask, though, is about that is, at least early on, you did resist the idea of film school for the idea that you wanted to do it yourself. Was that it in some way?
You know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with film school necessarily. I just figured out pretty early on that it wasn't for me. And I also kind of felt like, there's something about filmmakers' work. The certain filmmakers who don't come strictly from only a filmmaking background oftentimes, do the best work, I think. Or even writers like Raymond Chandler was an oil man for years and years before he even wrote his first book. And so sometimes I think back, well, maybe I shouldn't have made my first movie at 23 and just, done something else and then started making movies when I was 40. And then I'd probably skip over all this kind of developmental artist development phase. I don't know.
But why do you think that is, though, that they make better films or possibly can make better films because they have an original perspective, that they're not bound to any tradition or any kind of form?
I think that's possible, or it's also possible that they just have insider knowledge about a certain about a certain subject and are able to like this filmmaker Shane Carruth, who made Primer and Upstream Color. He was an engineer, and then he quit to make Primer, and Primer is an engineer's movie. that movie could not have been made by somebody who spent $250,000 going to Tisch and school just never agreed with me.
Yeah.
That's just what it came down to. Right. I just flat out didn't like it. There were many professors that I really loved and were close with and everything. But the whole thing just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. So I just stopped. I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of friends who went to film school and had a great experience and it really worked out great for them, but for me, I think that I'm glad that I didn't do it personally.
But how is it that, what did you know about filmmaking when you decided to make a film? I mean, how raw were you to the
absolutely
process?
Nothing.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I knew what I wanted.
Yeah.
And I knew
some
basics.
That's the first step, right?
But I made a film. It was sort of a featurette, and it's only been shown publicly once. Never took it to any film festivals or anything like that. It's sort of like the secret, the secret first feature that nobody will ever see again. I just used whatever I had on hand. I had like one of those little handy cams and shot a lot of it on that. I put up a bunch of posters at BYU asking for anybody who had like a nice camera to call me. And the one guy who called me was this guy, Dwayne Anderson, who ended up producing all four of my first feature films, and worked on Man from Reno as well. So, he had a camera and he's like, well, he clearly could see that I had no idea what I was doing. But we both kind of stumbled through it together and kind of learned the nuts and bolts of putting it together.
How much was it before you decided to approach the project? I mean, did you have it written? Did you have a very clear, defined...
The first one?
Yeah.
Yeah, it did.
And now the first one was...
Big Dreams, Little Tokyo.
Big Dreams, Little Tokyo, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that one was very... I had this huge script. It was kind of all over the place and I was married to every single thing on it, and my first lesson in filmmaking was going to my first meeting with Dwayne to talk about breaking down the script for the budget, and I was showing him all these intricate storyboards that I had drawn. He's like, oh, these are great, you're not gonna be able to do any of this. And I was like, oh man. But I quickly learned kind of the ruthlessness that it takes in filmmaking to basically hone in on what you can actually do, and managing resources as well as figuring out what's telling the story and what's not. I mean, it's something that I'm still learning, for sure. But it's that first film was a huge crucial step. Lots of failures along the way that kind of that taught me. It was basically like 4 years of film school in 6 months.
Right. So. How does the writing work for you? I know you have you did have a writing partner anyway. Joel Clark was one of your writing partners.
Yeah. We still work together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I don't really consider myself a writer. I'm kind of jealous of real writers, because when I think of a writer, I think of somebody who goes into a room and just like does it, you know, and just makes it. And for me, the writing is less of an art and more of a craft. You know, I spend a lot of time in the at least now. You know, I'm on my very first movies. The first two, I just sat down and just wrote it all the way through. I think that's to the film's detriment. I don't think I can do that, you know.
Wait, why? What do you mean?
I don't think that personally I direct well or that I work well unless there's structure to the story.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be set up and payoff. It has to be really, really carefully put together. Like the mechanics of, or like the dialogue and everything in the actual scene comes later. You know, first I'll spend with my co-writer or co-writers in some cases, weeks and weeks just pounding out the story and figuring out the detail of everything that happens in the scene, you know, visually, and how are we going to get this idea across, and, you know, figuring out what's going to come across through dialogue, what's going to cross. It's really kind of, it's like making a blueprint, you know, whereas other people, I mean, I read about the Coen brothers, how they can just sit down in a room together with a laptop and they just start from page one and just write all the way through. My brain just doesn't work that well, or just doesn't work like that, you know? And
so are you seeing it in images?
I see it in a combination of images, but mostly in terms of like story threads or scenes or set pieces,
as
I call them, you know, or not as I call them. I didn't make up the term. But,
no, I got it.
But, you know, like in Hitchcock's North by Northwest, the scene where Cary Grant goes out to wait for the guy by the side of the road, and then the crop duster guy starts swooping at him. Like that whole set piece right there is kind of like a mini movie in and of itself. And so I kind of tend to think of the movie in terms of set pieces and then connective tissue on how it works together. Like on my first film in Big Dreams, Little Tokyo, there's this big dinner scene where they're having to translate from Japanese to English to Spanish and then back and forth, and it's all kind of this telephone game. And then so it's like one long set piece that takes up 20 minutes of the movie, you know, but it's all kind of one contained thing.
It's a lot of work, though, that process, isn't it? I mean...
Yeah. It is.
It seems, and I think there are moments I've heard you actually talk about in Man from Reno. There's this scene with Watanabe, as a matter of fact, where he comes to the door of
Hayako's.
Yeah, her hotel room, and it's like it's such an interesting scene because a lot of what happens is just her looking through the peephole in the door, and him deciding how to approach the door, leaving, turning, coming back, leaving, turning, coming back. And it seems like such a simple thing, but I've heard you talk about how kind of complex that was. And if you think about just the way you would shoot it, I guess it's pretty intricate, that scene, that process.
Yeah, I mean, the shots themselves are very, very simple. Yeah. You know, there's no... it's just the sheer number of them that it takes to get those pieces that you need to put together to create tension in the audience's mind. I mean, I've always been fascinated by, you know, the creation of tension out of thin air. Yeah. You know, where very little is happening. I mean, Hitchcock and Polanski are kind of the gold standard masters of being able to do that. And that scene's actually my favorite one in Man from Reno. It was a lot of fun to do. You know, it's just kind of all about dialing in the performance and holding back information from the audience. Cause the audience doesn't know what's happening yet. They're not even going to be able to piece together what that scene was about until after the movie is over. But in the moment when they're watching it, they have to believe that everything's happening for a reason,
yeah.
or they have to believe that there's the potential for violence, for terror, for something to happen. But it's that potential, you know, the suspense that I think is really, really fascinating and fun to try to build as a director.
The pacing, I guess that's part of the editing too, right? I mean, you have to really sit with it and say, all right, how long do I hold this shot?
Because
you have to hold it. I mean, if it's too much, I guess you'll know, right? Or you'll have a sense of it anyway, right?
Yeah. There's a little bit of trial and error, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I mean, I actually make most of my living as an editor these days. And I edit other people's films too. And I co-edited Man from Reno with a couple of other people. But it is this constant chess game where, you know, you'll put the movie together and then maybe show it to a few people to kind of see how it plays. And somebody will say, and everybody will agree, like, this scene is too long or doesn't work for some reason. And then as you go back into it, what you find is there's nothing wrong with that scene necessarily. It's that the audience hasn't been prepared, you know, for what you're trying to – they haven't been prepared for what they're about to receive there.
Right.
And so they don't know what the point is, you know. And, I mean, with Man from Reno, we kind of went for a little bit more classical pace, by which I mean it's a little bit slower than your average Hollywood blockbuster, because you kind of need that to slowly build the tension. And, you know, you kind of can't have the explosive climax without the tense buildup. It's kind of not one without the other. And I'm a big believer in, you know, in really milking it.
Dave Boyle, he directed the feature film Man from Reno, which we are screening tonight at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's all part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Dave Boyle is going to be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the filmmaker Dave Boyle. This is the latest film in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center, though this month we're trying something different. Boyle's film, Man from Reno, isn't a documentary. It's a neo-noir thriller that follows a Japanese mystery writer on her strange journey through San Francisco. Her story collides with that of a small-town sheriff investigating a possibly connected missing persons case.
Well, let's talk about the story of Man from Reno, at least to the degree we can. This is a, I guess the suspense thriller. This is a subject that you've always had an affection for, this genre.
Mm-hmm.
You really
like
this.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, I love, you know, Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, or obvious kind of references on. I always wanted to do. It seemed like in at least in the classic film noir detective movies of the 1940s, it was always these square-jawed, you know, white guys.
Yeah.
I wanted to do something kind of along the lines of one of those classic crime novels, but have two parallel stories going on at once, and have a really unlikely team-up. And the most unlikely team-up I could come up with was a young Japanese female writer and a sheriff who's probably past retirement age but just won't go kind of thing.
When did they, like, what was the thing that got you started? Was it a story concept? Was it the characters? Like, how did it work? Where did it come from, the idea?
Oddly enough, it started from the title.
Really?
Yeah. It started with the title because I was just joking with, you know, a couple years ago when I was doing PR for, one of my films when it was coming out, I, you know, sometimes you sit in a room and you just answer the same questions all day.
Yeah.
And I just started when people ask me, what are you doing next? I just started making stuff up, you know, like, oh, I'm directing this movie called Brett Hollywood MILF Mania, you know, I just started making up titles and then I kind of had to cut it out because they were starting to published that and it was showing up on IMDb and stuff. But but I did one time just kind of make an offhand remark, like, oh, I'm going to make a movie called Man from Reno, but none of it's going to take place in Reno.
Yeah.
You know? But then, like, started talking about it more, and I was like, that actually might be kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a start.
It's a start. It's something. But the seed of the idea was basically just one story that is a more kind of emotional, character-driven thing, which is Ayako's story, and the other one that is a more traditional, you know, for all intents and purposes, like a murder of the week type of thing, yeah. Like Law and Order or Matlock or something like that. And having those two parallel stories come together, you know, in some way, and taking the kind of things that people expect from those mystery stories and somehow subverting them or twisting them, you know, like it's got to be like the best episode of Murder, She Wrote that anybody's ever seen. was sort of like the the low bar goal.
But then that's up against the Maltese Falcon strand, right? The really noir sort of brooding. So let's talk about Ayaka Fujitani, her character. She's, I mean, the actor herself, she's a writer. She's a novelist.
She is,
too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But her character in Man from Reno is she's a writer. And I won't say too much about her. Like, we can't say too much, so don't worry. I'm not going to give anything away. But the basic conceit is she's a writer. And she's wildly popular in Japan, comes to America. Only one of her books has been published in America. She comes to San Francisco on a book tour. But she feels like a fraud. Something's going on. Things aren't quite right. And say something more about her as a character, what you were thinking about.
Well, I was kind of fascinated by the idea of getting wrapped up in some kind of murder mystery while you're in the middle of like a PR tour. Because
you've been through them?
Because I've been through them, yeah.
That's so twice you've referenced these junkets, by the way.
Yeah. And the kind of junkets that I've been through are nothing compared to, you know, what big Hollywood things go through. But it's still, it does, you know, you're kind of, you do kind of have to tell your life story many, many times. And you do start to kind of feel like a fraud in a way. But I wanted to have her be a character that was not like a Jessica Fletcher in Murder, She Wrote, where they're squeaky clean and they don't have any darkness to them. I wanted her to be a character who had secrets and who was not necessarily the most likable person in the world. You know, she shows up in San Francisco and which is where she went to college in the movie. And she hasn't seen her friends there in years and years, hasn't been in touch. You know, she's somebody who's slightly prickly in a way. So I think that it was the idea that this murder mystery that she gets wrapped up on and kind of pulls her out of this downward spiral that she's in, paradoxically.
Yeah, because it's exciting to her. It's something real.
It's something real, yeah. So she's not really afraid of the danger. She's just glad that there's something going on. So.
That makes her actually feel alive.
Right.
Yeah. Pepe Serna, we were talking off air earlier. He has this iconic role in movies because he gets chainsawed to death in Scarface.
Right.
and he's one of these, I guess he's one of these sidekick, you know, characters, but you've worked with him before.
I have, yeah. He had a cameo role in White on Rice, and he was in my very first film, Big Dreams, Little Tokyo. And he, you know, I was trying to get this guy named James Shigeta, who unfortunately passed away last year, but I was trying to get him to be in that film and in the role of a Japanese businessman. And he and Pepe were represented by the same agent. And then they introduced us, and, you know, he's one of those guys that you've seen his face a thousand times.
Yeah.
Watching his demo reel is so funny because it's like him with Clint Eastwood and him with Meryl Streep and him with, and then he's died, I don't know, you know, 300 times in the movies.
Right.
But he is just a great actor and a great presence, you know, on a set. You know, he's one of those people that you're just always happy to have around.
In what way? Just nice guy? Everybody just, like,
he's just a character, yeah. You know? He keeps in between takes, he's doing his one-man show. Like in the movie, in Man from Reno is actually really a stretch for him, because he's usually the guy who comes in and plays the hyperactive, really colorful side character. And then in Man from Reno, he plays the kind of role that, you know, would usually go to somebody like Tommy Lee Jones or something, where he's taciturn and, you know, a man's man, a guy who kind of lets the lines in his face do the talking for him.
Yeah.
And so that was exciting for both of us, for me to watch him kind of figure out that, hey, I'm going to be on screen for almost the whole 2 hours. So I don't have to like grab it by the throat and throttle it. I can kind of let my face do the talking for me. So
he's a small town sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting relationship with his daughter. There's kind of a give and take there.
Yeah. I kind of wish that seemed like the kind of thing that I wish it was like a whole TV series. I could develop that further, but they do. He works with his daughter. We don't learn all that much about him, because he's more the classic detective character.
But I liked that, actually. Mm-hmm. I liked that you knew there was a big backstory there, and you knew there was something going on in the relationship with his daughter, and you could tell he was a fixture of the town because he went and got his hair cut, the barbershop, and all that stuff. But you didn't make too much of it. You know, you just sort of hinted at it. I kind of liked that, actually, about it.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to keep it a little bit more in the realm of subtext, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard in a you know, we're already delving so deep into Ayako's character's head that Pepe's character really needed to kind of be the rock that the audience holds on to and likes the whole way through. And, you know, he's the sheriff, he's doing his job as to the best of his abilities anyway, and he's just doing his thing.
Yeah. Let's see, Kazuki Kitamura.
Kazuki Kitamura, yeah.
He's a big deal in Japan.
He is, yeah. Yeah, he's a big star. Even though this is a small indie movie, there's a lot of anticipation among his fans. They're always taking screen grabs from our trailer. And,
really?
You know, yeah. Decorating them with heart shapes and everything. But, he was great. He was really, even though, you know, you never know when you have, like, a big star on an indie movie set if they're going to be upset that they don't have a trailer or that kind of thing. But
if craft services isn't right or whatever.
Yeah. But, you know, in Japan, when they say that they shot a movie in 21 days, they mean 21 days in a row and, you know, 18-hour days. There are no unions or anything like that. So we thought that we were, like, killing ourselves, you know. We were just flying through this stuff as fast as we could. And he, for him, it was like a picnic. He was like, man, this is so great. We really got to really dive into that scene. And I was like, what are you talking about? We only did three takes, you know? And he's like, yeah, but, you know.
Wow.
I guess they really
push him.
They really push him in Japan.
What's your directing technique like? How do you, I mean, I know a lot of people, once you get things in place, you just trust actors to let them do it. And they're kind of, some directors are standoffish. They're not really part of the process. Others are really engaged, probably a little obnoxious for actors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where are you in that process?
I think it's a mix of both. It kind of depends on what the scene and what the particular actor and everybody else needs. I mean, before the movie starts, my DP and I on Man from Reno is Richard Wong. We got together in San Francisco and just spent a week just going through the script and talking about every scene and how we were going to cover it, what we were trying to accomplish there. And in some places, you know, he would, and there's also sort of the budget and time constraints that we have to talk about. There's sometimes the best choice is to make the simple choice because you don't, because there is no other choice. You know, it's either we shoot it this way or there's no scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I try to rehearse as much as I can. Like Kazuki came in a day early, and we spent a day in a conference room with him and Ayako, just going over their scenes. And especially since they were in Japanese, and he had a lot of very particular ideas about how to make sure that it would stay natural for the Japanese viewers and everything. On set, you know, I think that it's just kind of all about kind of reading the cues about what people need sometimes. Yeah. I mean, sometimes people need very, very specific direction actors by and large hate getting what's called line readings where you say, no, say it like this. And then you say it and have them. But you know, sometimes you have to do it. Sometimes actors need that. Sometimes all actors need is just to say a little less, a little more. Sometimes if it's a really technical scene where it's things like eye lines are really important, where they're looking at something and you need to kind of have the screen direction and everything all set in stone so the audience can follow what the scene is about, then that sometimes gets really, really particular. Like you need to walk into the room and hit this mark, and then you say your line, and then you stand and I'd never say it like that,
sure.
You know, on set, but that's pretty much what it comes down to. It's just making sure that, and then other times, and this is my favorite thing to do. I found that usually the best results come when you don't say anything to the actors and see what they do on the first rehearsal and see where they go in the room, you know, and then you and the cinematographer watch the rehearsal and figure out where to put the camera for each of the setups. And when you do that for whatever reason, it just always works better than trying to fit people into a box. But sometimes you have no choice and they got to go in the box.
We can't get through this interview without me at least mentioning this, and I'm not sure how she feels about mentioning it, but Ayako Fujitani's father is Steven Seagal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is kind of, that's kind of cool. I mean, did she grow up? She grew up in Japan, though.
She grew
for
up
the
in
most
Japan.
Part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't really know. I know that they, you know, they. She and her dad seem to have a perfectly fine relationship with each other. I don't know him. You know, I've never met him.
He didn't come on set.
He didn't come on set. Yeah. You know, he's very much involved in his own thing, but they're in touch with each other.
I wanted to ask you, what do you think about the term Mormon filmmaker? Like, I mean, I know it used to be, and maybe it still is. I always got the sense that a lot of Mormon filmmakers made films about, you know, missionary experiences or stories about faith and belief.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? I mean, do you sort of bristle at the idea of, I mean, you know, you have a Mormon background, but I mean, what do you think about being defined that way? Do you run from that? Do you really care much about that? Do you even think about that?
Well, I guess I kind of feel about it the same way Ayako feels about, you know, being Steven Seagal's daughter. You know, it's definitely not something that I have ever hid or run from or anything, but I just remember a couple years ago I was at this film festival and they brought me up to introduce the movie before the screen started, and the guy was in Chicago, and the guy was like, here's Dave, he's this Mormon from Utah, what's this Mormon guy making these Asian movies for? Anyway, we're going to bring him back after that, we're going to get to the bottom of this, why this Mormon is making these Asian movies.
Yikes.
And it was, you know, it was perfectly fine, but it completely derailed the audience's expectations for the movie. So the Q&A session afterward, the kind of questions I was getting were like, what sort of precepts from the Book of Mormon were you hoping to teach with this movie?
And
I was
wow.
Like, this is a movie about a guy who wants to play his guitar and get the girl, you know, like there's nothing more to it than that kind of thing. And so, you know, it's the kind of thing that I've definitely been somewhat private or guarded about, but yeah. It's not, because I, you
but
know.
Does it, but does it bother you that some Mormon filmmakers can only make movies about missionaries and faith?
Well, if that's what they want to do, that's fine.
Sure.
I mean, I'd love to see somebody come up with a different take on it, you know.
Yeah. I just think it's so interesting. I mean, take Man from Reno. I mean, there's some sex in the film. It's fairly tame, but there's language in the film. It's, I guess, fairly tame, but I guess as a, you don't have any compunction about that, obviously.
No, not really. I mean, I never, I guess I'm one of those people who sort of compartmentalizes a lot of that stuff in a way.
Well, I think a lot of people do.
Yeah. I mean, for me, a lot of that stuff is more kind of storytelling aesthetic considerations than it is, any kind of moralizing. I mean, I do kind of, I would love someday to make a quote unquote Mormon movie. I would love to. I just feel that the Mormon audiences, by and large, will not accept anything that isn't 100% innocuous, and I don't see myself making that Mormon movie. Right. You know. So,
let me ask you finally. You've said that. You're not sure why you did comedies because you like the darker, more suspenseful stuff. Are you sticking with that genre for now? And the things that you're at least thinking about or working on now?
I am. You know, some of it's lighter than other. Some of my projects are lighter than others, but by and large, they're in the dramatic or suspense thriller genres. There's something that I'm hopefully. I actually wrote a TV pilot that I'm taking out and trying to set up, and then I have a feature film also that hopefully I can make later this year. Both of which are, you know, even darker than Man from Reno. So once you get a taste of the darkness, it's hard to go back. Yeah.
That's Dave Boyle. He directed the feature film Man from Reno, and we are screening it tonight at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. Come and join us. It's all part of our Through the Lens film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Dave Boyle is going to be there for a Q&A after the film, and you can get the details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.